Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Bright Brains Podcast. Today, my guest is Sarah Eldridge. She is a therapist in New York, and she wants to talk about how the emerging paradigms of trauma and neurodiversity offer an opportunity to really rethink mental health therapy and how we can treat these issues. So welcome to the podcast, Sarah.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
Awesome. So tell us a little bit about yourself and how long have you been a therapist?
Yeah. So I am a licensed clinical social worker based in New York. I graduated with my MSW, my master's in social work in 2015. So I started my career working at a domestic violence agency, and I did that for about 6 years. And then for the last 2.5 years, I've been a therapist in a group practice.
Awesome. All right, then. So you came on to talk about mental health, trauma, and neurodiversity. So let's hop into it. What is it about these issues or these topics that are important to you? And why should they be also be important to our audience?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. So first of all, I think these topics are really intertwined and really connected because a lot of folks who identify as neurodivergent have also experienced trauma. And so I don't think we can talk about one without talking about the other. But for the purposes of our discussion today, I will separate them out a little bit. So when we think about the trauma paradigm, right, or understanding mental health trauma and why that's important, you know, historically in mental health, we've gone through a few different models, right? So one is this model of Freudian, right? If we take it all the way back 150 years or so, we look at Freud, and Freud was really much looking at all these sort of innate things that he thought that we were born with, right? So if we think about the Oedipus complex, right, and all of these, you know, he thought we had all these like drives for sex and violence, and these were just innate to us. And so we had to figure out how to, you know, tamp down on that stuff and be a functioning member of society. And then in the last, you know, really in the 20th century, we saw a lot of a move towards more looking at behavior and then thinking about mental health issues as, you know, like a brain disease, right? So we just need to figure out like the gene that contributes to depression or anxiety, and we're just going to fix it. And then that'll be it. Right. And I think all of these perspectives have some value that they can offer. But what I think is really important and what I think is so valuable about understanding trauma is understanding that the things that have happened to us as individuals and also the things that have happened to our family members and to our communities, both in our own lifetimes, but even before we were born, really impact us and the ways in which we move through the world and think about the world, right? When we think about trauma, trauma is something that happens to us that really overwhelms our ability to cope, right? And so in that moment of something traumatic happening, right, whether it's a singular incident, or maybe it's a chronic trauma like homelessness or poverty or child abuse, our brains and bodies develop different coping skills to sort of manage, right? It's just our brain goes into survival mode. It's trying to keep us alive. And what happens a lot of times is when we are no longer in that immediate crisis, a lot of these survival tactics or coping skills, they don't work as well anymore, right? So it could be really great as a child if your response to conflict is flight, right? Run away, go hide in your room while your parents are fighting. That's not a great coping skill as an adult if we avoid all conflicts with partners and friends and coworkers by just running away, right? And so for me, if I take a trauma perspective on the work that I'm doing, it's trying to understand that it's not that you're a terrible person. It's not that I think there's anything wrong with you that my job is to fix. It's to understand how have you adapted to the world, right? And again, if we look back, maybe how has your family adapted to a world that experienced trauma, right? And how can we help you develop some better ways of moving through the world that are going to suit you better now, right? Is it really in your best interest to be constantly fighting and constantly angry all the time, right? Maybe it was when you were a kid. Maybe it was for your family when they came here as, you know, immigrants in 1932. But maybe that's not such a great survival strategy anymore, right? So how can we navigate through that? So that's why I think it's really important that we're talking about trauma, right? Because trauma is, I think, is a much more healthier way of looking at folks, is adapting to their circumstances. And then if we think about neurodiversity, right, it's similar in that we're not looking at people as, again, like, what's wrong with you? You know, what's your like disability and why don't you fit into the world around you? What we're trying to understand is that some of us, some people have brains that are just different than what we would consider to be typical, right? And that could be autism, that could be ADHD. There are various other conditions. You know, it's a little bit of a fuzzy line, right? How we define this. But it's just a different way of being in the world, right? And instead of it being like, oh, there's something wrong and we need to fix it, can we instead take a perspective of, this is just who you are. This is how you move through the world. And how can we adapt to that, right? How can we make society more adaptive and inclusive so that you function better, so that you're not getting traumatized by an environment that's not made for you, and we can be really supportive, right? So I think these perspectives are so important because it's less focused on trying to fix people or put them into boxes or just make them like better part of society, and more like, okay, how can society be more inclusive and understanding of people and the things that they've been through and the ways in which they see the world?
All right, then. So this is interesting. I was writing down numerous questions just based on some of the things that you said. So let's start here. I have a two-pronged question. One, what exactly is like neurodiversity? What is the textbook definition like? And also, has neurodiversity gone up among the population?
That's a great question.
Yeah, because I've noticed a lot more people talking about this than usual. So I'll let you have the mic.
Absolutely. No, I think that's so important. So I really appreciate that, right? So neurodiversity is a term that was coined in like the 80s by an Australian therapist. And the idea is basically, I wish I could give you the literal definition, but the idea that there are natural and normal differences in neurological functioning, right? Mm-hmm. That's a very sort of, let's start there, right? That differences in brain functioning are natural and normal, and they are part of the overall diversity of humanity, right? Just like we have different colored eyes and different handedness, right? Some of us might be really great athletes and some of us are really great artists. Some of us see the world and we're going to be interacting with the world differently, right? And so when I say differently, what that tends to mean, if we're thinking about things like autism, we're thinking about things like ADHD, we're really talking about how you are perceiving and responding to the sensory input that you are getting from your environment, right? And how you are then responding based on how you receive that information, right? That's a big, big component of anything that's really neurodivergent is folks' responses to the sensory information in their environment, right? So that's, you know, and again, like it's a bit of a fluid concept and there's differences, you know, there's a difference of opinion of like, you know, is something like a bipolar disorder, you know, a neurodiversity, right? Or anxiety, what's acquired, what is inborn? So it's a little flexible. We're still figuring that out. Seems pretty clear that autism, though, is something that folks are just born with, right? They're just born with it. This is just how they move through the world. And no amount of therapy or medication is going to fundamentally change some of these things, right? Now, whether or not this is increasing, I think, you know, it's always hard to know because even the word autism, right, that concept is not very old at this point, maybe like 100 years old or so, 150. It's not very old. And the, you know, psychological diagnoses also, that's relatively recent that we use the DSM to diagnose folks. So I just want to say whether or not it's actually increasing so much as our awareness of these divergences is increasing. And I think that's a big difference, right? I think as we are expanding our understanding and expanding our categories, and quite frankly, a lot of these diagnoses, you know, historically were based on like little white boys, right? And that's not to denigrate. Little white boys need help and support. But what that means is we looked at them and we said, that's what it means to be autistic. That's what it means to have ADHD. And so women and folks of color and immigrants and people who didn't speak English, they got other types of diagnoses if they got diagnosed at all, right? So kids of color are more likely to get things like oppositional defiant disorder or even schizophrenia, when really it's probably something more like autism and ADHD, right? So I think that's also part of what's shifting, is that we're starting to realize that our categories were based on very limited sample sizes, and that actually we need to be much more inclusive in what we're looking at.
All right. Now, you said that most people who are neurodivergent have had trauma in their life. Why is that?
Absolutely. Great question. So I would say, first of all, I think all of us experience trauma. But when I'm thinking specifically of neurodivergent folks, I think a lot of that comes down to we don't historically have a great understanding of what neurodivergence is or how to accommodate it. And so what winds up happening is that we're trying to force folks to fit into a society, to fit into a world that is really not made for them and that they don't understand, right? And so it can be really traumatizing from a physical perspective. I mean, a lot of kids with autism, you know, they struggle with like eating, for example, right? Or because they have really intense sensory issues, right? And their parents understandably can get really frustrated and feel like their kid is, you know, refusing to eat, or, oh my God, my child's going to starve to death. And so rather than looking at the sensory issue of like, maybe they just don't like the way that that food feels in their mouth, they can get punished for it, right? And there can be a lot of like, you know, screaming and criticizing, right? The same thing with any kind of sensory stimulation. A lot of the stereotypes that we have about autistic kids, right? Where they're like, you know, these little kids like rocking in a corner or like throwing a fit. What we're starting to realize is that a lot of that is about sensory overstimulation, feeling dysregulated, feeling confused, right? A lot of neurodivergent folks need a lot of predictability. They need things to be really explained to them. And a lot of times we don't do that, right? Things just kind of happen. You know, parents are like, oh, we're going to go to the store. You know what? Never mind. We're not going to go to the store today. We're going to go to grandma's house, right? Okay, but for a kid, an autistic kid, or even a kid with ADHD, and that's what they thought was going to happen, and it doesn't, it's incredibly dysregulating. And nobody's explaining that to them. Nobody's even understanding that that is something it's okay to be upset about, right? So we have this lack of understanding, trying to force people to fit in, right? That's a part of it. Kids, unfortunately, can be really, I don't want to say just kids, kids and adults, kids, teachers, parents, anyone, are not always very kind to folks that we don't understand. So there can be a lot of, you know, social punishment that happens for folks who don't fit in or don't follow the social rules, right? I know that for me, as someone who grew up and was not diagnosed with ADHD until I was an adult, you know, I really struggled in school. Like, I liked to learn, but I was like very chatty, and I would doodle all the time, and I would get my homework in at the last minute. And I got a lot of criticism from teachers because of that, right? Now, I don't want to say that this is some, you know, this was horribly traumatic for me, but it definitely impacted my sense of self-esteem and my sense of self-worth, right? To feel like, wow, like, why can't I just get it together, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, fortunately, I think my parents were, you know, loving and supportive. But for folks who maybe don't have all those resources, right, and they're getting all these negative messages, that can be really traumatizing to feel like, well, what's wrong with me, right? I'm just, something is wrong and nobody is explaining it, right? And then the last thing I think is really important is a lot of neurodivergent folks, because they struggle with understanding like social cues and social interactions, and there can be a very a tendency to be very people pleasing, because it feels like, well, I don't really understand what's happening, but I'm just going to go along with this because I think that that's what other people want me to do. Sometimes I can get into situations that are maybe like abusive relationships, right? Or develop friendships that are maybe not very healthy for them and it can be kind of traumatizing because they're just kind of going along with it and they don't really get it. And they might stay longer because they're like, well, I guess this is what I'm supposed to do. I guess dating looks like being with somebody who hurts me and takes advantage of my boundaries and does all of this kind of stuff, right? Because they don't really understand, or they may even feel like, well, I'm not going to find anybody else because who else is going to want someone who's as weird and disabled as me? Right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things that can show up that can cause trauma for neurodivergent folks.
All right, then. So you say that the way we treat these individuals has to change. So what changes has to be made? Because I know you just talked about your experiences being neurodivergent, and also, you know, everybody is different in a way. So how can we make changes that help everybody when everybody is different?
Absolutely. What a great question, right? We're all different. So I think let's start there, right? Acknowledging that we're all different. Even quote unquote neurotypical kids are different. Everybody learns differently. So some folks are going to learn really well. They love to read, right? And that's going to be great for them. And other folks are going to have a lot easier time sitting in a classroom and hearing that teacher talk to them, right? And they're going to learn well that way. Obviously, I can't expect that like every teacher, you know, they have like what, 30 kids in the classroom. They're not going to be able to tailor it for every kid. Same thing, you know, maybe when we're in like the workforce, I don't expect you to individually tailor for everyone. But I think what we can start with is number one, obviously, education and training, right? I think, you know, when I was going to school for social work, I didn't get any kind of education or training on neurodivergence, right? On autism, on ADHD. And this was about 10 years ago. So maybe things, you know, I'd hope things are getting a little bit better, but I didn't know anything about this unless, you know, it was kind of like, maybe if you wanted to work with kids, you might have to know about this, right? Kids turn into adults, right? Yeah. And I think, again, this idea that like, oh, an autistic kid, okay, you'll work with them in school. And then maybe as an adult, maybe they'll like live in a group home or something. And so you're probably not going to encounter them. That's actually, again, we're seeing that's not true. Plenty of autistic adults live independently and live with partners and family. And so therapists are going to run into neurodivergent people. And we need to know how to work with them. And we need to know how to assess for neurodivergence, right? Instead of just saying you're anxious, you're depressed, relying on these old our usual sort of fallback categories. What if there's something else going on there, right? So that's number one, I think, is important for anyone who's in the helping professions, right? Doctors, teachers, anyone who's doing that needs to have at least like a basic understanding of what this is. I'm not asking that like every teacher has to be able to diagnose an ADHD kid, but like at least start to recognize what some of the signs might be. You have a kid who's really seems really smart, but they can't seem to like get their homework in on time and their desk is super messy and they're chit-chatting. Well, is it that they're disobedient, or maybe they could have ADHD, right? So keeping these things in mind. Once we have that basic understanding, is then let's do some kind of assessment with someone of like, okay, what are your sensory needs? It's actually not that hard. Like we all have sensory needs, right? Most of us are going to have situations where we feel better. Some people like to be in a quiet cabin by the woods, right? I live in the middle of New York City and I love it. That is not for everybody, right? And even I have days where I'm like, oh my God, I hate everybody who lives here, right? So how can we say like, okay, let's have options for folks, right? We can like turn some of the lights down. We can have a room, you know, or a corner of a classroom or a corner of your therapy office that has like blankets and fidget toys to play with and things like that, right? Can we make sure that a kid who gets overwhelmed by sounds, can we let them wear, you know, like headphones or something when they're in class, right? How can we accommodate and understand that these accommodations are not, it's not inconveniencing us. And it also, we should all have accommodations all the time, right? Ability, disability are temporary things. Again, I live in New York. And so a few years ago, and I'm generally, you know, an able-bodied person. But a few years ago, I broke a bone in my foot, and I was using like a cane, and I had a boot on my foot. And so, you know, you take the subway. So I'd go up and down the stairs, and it was terrible. It's terrible to go up and down flights of stairs with a cane. And there were days where I just wanted to sit on the subway, right? Or just sit somewhere while I'm waiting for my train. And that wasn't really accessible to me, right? And so when we're thinking about accommodations and accessibility, it's also for all of us, right? Because we're all going to have moments where we need to maybe take a step back, leave a crowded room, and be able to sit in a corner, right? And just like chill on our phones or like not talk to anybody. We all need moments where we need to sit down. Right. So that's what I want us to think about is, you know, how can we have a variety of options available to folks, different settings, different stimulations, et cetera, for everybody. So that's kind of how I want to think about it.
So one thing you said that when you were in school for social work, that you weren't taught anything about neurodiversity or anything like that, which I think that's pretty interesting. Were you went to school for social work for teens, right? Or was it?
It was just a school for social work. Yeah, I went to the City University of New York here in New York City, Silverman School of Social Work. It was your pretty standard social work program. Yeah.
Yeah. So how did you learn about all this? Was it just self-study or just your own experiences? Or
Yeah. It was a combination of things. You know, when I was working at my agency job, I provided counseling to survivors of domestic violence, as well as sometimes their kids. And I actually worked with a teenager who was autistic. And so that was my first introduction to really working with someone autistic. And he was really great and bright and really loving and caring. And I was like, oh, wow, you know, not that I know so much about this, but I feel like all my stereotypes that I've heard seem wrong, right? Because this kid, yeah, maybe he doesn't look me in the eye, but he has a lot to say, right? And so that got me interested to start learning about it. And then, you know, my own journey during the pandemic, like many of us, I had a lot of time to myself, and I really struggled. I, you know, did not, you know, I had a job, but working remotely is very different from working in person. And so to shift from like going into the office every day and being around folks, and all of a sudden I'm here and doing counseling sessions with people over the phone, it was really hard for me, right? I feel like I did not have a lot of structure to my days. I feel like there also just wasn't a lot of stimulation, and it was really hard for me to self-generate that. And those things together, you know, my husband had been telling me for years, like, I think you might have ADHD. And I was like, no, I don't. And then I was like, oh no, this is really bad. I got to figure this out. So that really led me on my own journey for myself. And then in the past few years in my practice, you know, I didn't set out to work with ADHD or autism, but I've had folks come in who either, you know, have an official diagnosis, or they're like, you know, I've been doing some reading about this and I think that this might be applicable to me. Same thing with ADHD. I've had a lot of folks who like either are diagnosed or get diagnosed during our work together. And so I'm like, there's something here, right? There's something here that I need to learn more about, even if it's just to be able to go to someone and say, like, actually, I don't think it's autism. I think maybe there's something else that we need to talk about, right? But having all these people come to me, you know, part of it is people see it on social media, but that's fine. Like, social media can be really educational, you know, if we have an open mind and we're curious about it. It unlocks something where I was like, ah, I'm just seeing you as like, well, you have a lot of trauma. Well, you're depressed. Well, you're anxious. But if I add in this piece of neurodivergence and I start to say like, well, maybe the way that you're processing the world is different than I thought, right? Or different than I've been taught. Ah, I feel like that unlocks something here about what's going on. And so my normal sort of approaches of like, this is what we're going to do, that's not working, because you're getting overwhelmed by sensory information and you're shutting down. And so it's not enough to just say that you're anxious. Maybe that's part of it, but your nervous system is totally dysregulated because there's bright lights and there's too much conversation happening, right? And there's too many decisions to make and you can't do that. And so if I just tell you to like breathe a few times, that's not going to fix it. right? So that's really been the evolution for me, is hearing people trying to learn more about it and being like, I think this makes sense. I think this helps me understand folks in a different way.
All right, then. So what is the neurodiversity movement? So it's like a movement around neurodiversity?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a huge movement, right? So historically, you know, particularly autism, but, you know, ADHD too, I think, it's been very pathologized. Autism, you know, again, because we tend to think of it as like kids, it's been a lot of parents and advocates kind of speaking for autistic folks, right? And what we've really seen in the last couple of decades is people really starting to come out and speak up for themselves and say like, hey, you know, I don't need you to pathologize me. I don't need you to, you know, necessarily tell me that like, I can't work, I can't function. I can actually speak up for myself and I can actually advocate for myself and my own needs. And so we've really seen folks start to recognize that, right? And also folks say, you know, I don't have to be ashamed of this and I don't have to treat this as, you know, an illness, a disability, right? So if we go on this like little side journey for a minute, when we think about disability, there's the old school sort of medical model version of disability, right? Which is that like a disability is something that you have, right? And it's something that needs to be fixed or cured, right? So I have ADHD. So, you know, take your meds and get a planner and just like learn how to fix as best you can to like fit into society, right? Like you're probably is always going to be this way, but like figure that out, right? Same thing with autism. The approach was, well, we just got to teach autistic kids, you know, use behavioral therapy, get them to like fit better into society, right? Because something's wrong with them. A more social model, which is what a lot of neurodiversity advocates look at, is like, disability is not just you, right? It's also a factor of the social situations that we are in that are disabling to us, right? So a kid, an autistic kid who's having a meltdown because the lights are so bright, right? And there's so much noise happening and he has to switch classes every 45 minutes. Well, that's not necessarily because there's something wrong with him. It's because the way our society is set up doesn't suit him. If he was in a situation where it was like quieter and a little darker, and maybe he didn't have to switch all the time, he'd actually function a lot better, right? And so that's what the neurodiversity movement is really advocating for, is stop seeing us as a problem that needs to be fixed and like jammed into this box. And instead, let us identify for ourselves, you know, what are our strengths? What supports do we need? How can we be better supported to live a life that works with our brain instead of trying to force our brain to work in a model that doesn't actually make sense for it?
Is there any pushback to the neurodiversity movement?
Yeah, I think there is in a couple of different ways. I think one, honestly, I think sometimes it's hard for folks to feel that way, right? Sometimes folks are, you know, feel like, why should I be proud of this? Why you're telling me that I'm supposed to feel like, you know, oh, this is a neurodivergent. I feel disabled, right? I feel really disabled. And like, I'm not proud of the fact that I forgot to pay my electric bill, right? Or the fact that I didn't finish this assignment on time. Like, why should I embrace that, right? This is an illness, it's a disability, and I want it to be treated. Right. And so sometimes it's people themselves who are coming from that perspective. I think sometimes there's a little bit of a pushback from professionals who are just not that educated. And honestly think that it's just, you know, young people who are getting all their information from TikTok and don't really get it. And we need to be treating these as serious illnesses. So that's kind of the pushback that we see, is, you know, that this is a disability and that we need to fix it and treat it as one, right? That's the biggest thing. And then I think to your point also, it also a little bit of like, well, and how much accessibility do we need, right? Like, at what point do we stop? And like, maybe at some point you just have to like learn to like suck it up and get along, right? Like we can't be expected to make everything accessible. So that's a little bit of pushback, you know? But overall, I think we're moving in a direction where people are more understanding of it.
That's awesome. So you mentioned TikTok. Glad you mentioned that because I feel like with social media, you know, it's a blessing and a curse.
Yep.
You know, one way it's a blessing is it helps spread awareness. You know, people are talking about these kind of issues that they wouldn't be talking about before social media. But one thing about social media, and especially on TikTok, is I feel you have people who try to build a brand out of everything, you know? And so you have people who saying that, you know, they're autistic, or they have identity dissociative disorder, or
Oh, yeah.
Tourette's, and things like that. And I wonder, are these people for real, or is it just an act? And does it hinder real advocacy for neurodivergent folks?
Hey, sorry to interrupt, but are you looking to reach a dynamic and engaged audience of curious minds? Well, look no further. Bright Brains Podcast is the perfect platform to showcase your business or product. You'll be able to reach a diverse, intelligent audience and engage with listeners passionate about personal development, technology, and more. Elevate your brand through thought-provoking discussions. Don't miss this opportunity to promote your business on one of the fastest-growing podcasts in the market. Contact us today to discuss advertising options and elevate your brand to the next level. Contact us at brightbrainspod@gmail.com to secure your advertising spot on Bright Brains today. Again, that's Bright Brains with a Z, pod@gmail.com. Now, back to the podcast.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, I agree with you. It is a blessing and a curse, right? Because on the one hand, I think it could be really great to see just kind of ordinary people talking about their lives and how they function. But then on the other hand, there are all kinds of people who, you know, get on there and say stuff that's maybe not true or, you know, like it's very kind of like pop psychology, maybe not a lot of research backed. So I think with anything, right, we just need to have some critical thinking skills, right? And really, I think it's great. I love when people come into my office and they're like, hey, I've been seeing these TikToks, right? Because of course it's an algorithm. So you see one and then you like it and then you keep seeing all of them. So then you start to really think like, well, maybe I do have ADHD, right? But I love it. Folks come in and they're like, I'm thinking I have ADHD, right? Because I see all these TikToks and they really relate to me. Great. Let's slow down and talk about it. What is it there that resonates with you? What are the symptoms? Tell me the history, right, of it. Is it something that you just noticed today, or you really feel like this is going back right to your childhood, right? So I think it can be a helpful starting point. And I certainly have fallen victim to this myself sometimes, where I'll see a great TikTok video and then I'm like, oh my God, did you know this fact? And then people are like, that's not true. And I'm like, yes, you can Google it, but people feel really compelling. I think it can be a helpful starting point, right? And then I think it's helpful to take that then and do some additional research. There's a lot of great, you don't even have to talk to a therapist if you don't, but there are a lot of great books out there now written by people who are either diagnosed with these conditions, or therapists, you know, who have written about it. So there's a lot of great resources that you can find, by people who really have this and know about it. Or, yeah, talk to a mental health professional and be like, hey, I think this is going on with me. And hopefully your therapist or psychiatrist has enough curiosity to say like, okay, tell me more. Let's figure this out together. Right. So yeah, I've just taken it with that grain of salt.
So when you're working with a patient who are in your job as a social worker and you're dealing with someone who is neurodivergent and they have trauma, how do you go about helping them? Do you address that trauma first Or do you help them with the neurodivergent issue, or is it a little bit of the both?
I think it's really got to be a little bit of both, right? A lot of times with neurodivergence, what's happening is a lot of people are very they're very overstimulated, they're very dysregulated, and they don't even recognize it, right? They don't even recognize how hard they're maybe working to try and function in the world. And so a lot of the work is, okay, can we figure out a way to make your situation a little bit friendlier for your brain, right? So maybe that means, like, if you're working, can we adjust your work schedule, or can you take a day off, or what does that look like? Can we make sure from a sensory perspective that your home feels like soothing and comforting and all of that? So we have to make sure that folks are feeling a little bit more regulated. That's one of it. But the trauma is so intertwined, because what I often encounter with any kind of neurodivergence is there's a lot of shame that people feel, right? There's a lot of shame of, I should be able to do X, Y, and Z, right? I should be able to work a 50-hour work week. I should be able to, finish this, school assignment that's really boring and that I hate, and then everybody else can do it. And a lot of times that shame comes from trauma, right? It comes from the ways in which they've been expected to conform to neurotypical ideals, right? And so that's part of it, is I'm help hopefully we're helping to be like, hey, this is just how your brain works, right? We need to, make some peace with that shame, right? We need to have be kinder to ourselves and understand that it's not that we did anything wrong or that we're a bad person. And we need to let some of that go, right? But then it's also, as time goes on, helping folks even understand that the things that have happened to them are traumatic. And this is true for anyone, right? Neurodivergent, neurotypical is, I don't go in being like, okay, tell me your top 10 trauma stories, right? But over time, as we're developing relationship, and I can be like, wow, that sounds pretty intense. And a lot of folks, but particularly neurodivergent folks, who I think kind of adapt by learning to just take it, will be like, oh, so like you're telling me that was traumatizing, the way that my parent talked to me, right? Or that experience, that was traumatizing. And they might not have realized that before, because they were just used to like go along, make things work. I'm a bad person. I have to just fit into this box. And so someone outside of them saying like, yeah, it was actually like, that's not appropriate. People shouldn't treat you that way. That's part of also undoing some of that shame and helping them understand themselves better. So it's really all kind of connected. I think it starts with forming that relationship, having compassion and curiosity, and then starting to like peel back all these different layers, right, of what's coming up for them.
Do you think the way that maybe we as a society fail neurodivergent people is the cause of a lot of like social ills, like homelessness and crime and things like that?
Oh, absolutely. Of course. I think that's so relevant, right? There are so many folks who experience all types of neurodivergences, all types of mental health issues that we just completely fail to accommodate and to address. I mean, when we think about autistic folks, their outcomes are very poor, right? Like a lot of them don't aren't able to work full time. They do experience homelessness, mental health issues, substance use. And I do think a lot of it is the way that our society has failed folks, because we are expecting them to fit in and to conform, and we really punish them. And then if we again go back to what I mentioned earlier, which is, we've not done a great job of recognizing neurodivergence, particularly in kids of color. And so then they get a lot of these diagnoses, right? They get treated starting at a young age as, you have oppositional defiance, right? Or intermittent explosive disorder, or schizophrenia or bipolar or any of these other labels, right? That are not helpful. But then they help, what they do is they pathologize the kid. They give them this, they start to be seen as like, well, that's that bad child, right? So we have all these like stereotypes already in play, right? We might have racism and xenophobia and everything. Then we've put on this like mental illness label on this kid. So then it's like, well, they're this bad kid and we just gotta pass them along until what, right? They don't really get the help or the support that they need. And it's expensive a lot of times to get support for folks, right? To really get, you know, to maybe have a parent at home who can help them, right? A lot of parents can't afford to do that. They're not going to be able to like take time off from their job to take care of their neurodivergent kids. So they just kind of got to do the best they can, right? So then by the time, right, they become teenagers, they become adults, they just haven't had support. They haven't had it from parents, from schools, from anyone. And then they're left to try and muddle through and function in a society that maybe they don't really understand. Maybe they don't really have skills. Maybe they're deeply traumatized. And now we're like, good luck. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it's wild. So yeah, we definitely can see how a lot of social ills that affect our communities are from a lack of treating neurodivergent people with care. So my question is, what are some steps that individuals and communities can take to better support those who have experienced trauma and are also neurodivergent?
Yeah. Oof, there are so many things I think that we could do. I mean,
like I know I kind of asked that before, but I guess what I'm asking is like, what are some things that we could practical that we could do now? Like,
Absolutely. Okay. Mm-hmm. So again, one, education, so important. You know, I think because I spent several years working in agency settings and, you know, helping folks navigate systems, all of our systems, right, to get help are complicated and confusing and require a lot of time and energy. So we could make things simpler, right? I really believe we're smart. Humans are smart. We could figure out a way to make the process of applying for anything, jobs, apartments, public assistance, health insurance. We can make it a lot simpler, a lot more straightforward. You know, having, of course, you know, folks like social workers and case managers can be really helpful. I think that should be more accessible, right? We're starting to see, for example, that libraries in some places have social workers because we know that a lot of folks will go to the library to use the computers there. And so they started noticing a lot of unhoused folks, a lot of, you know, immigrants, a lot of people who need support were there. So they're like, cool, maybe we could hire a social worker who can help them navigate through these systems. So I think we need that. That could happen in all kinds of settings, right? I think we need a lot of like social workers and other supports that people could easily access to help them navigate help, right? Or navigate anything that they need because it's all confusing. But we can also make things like simpler. Like, why is the process of applying for a job this like 15 step, like go to this site, upload your resume and then retype your resume. And then like, I don't know, maybe there's two interviews, maybe there's one, nobody tells you what's happening. Like we could work to be a little clearer in our communication just as a society, right? But also, how can we have empathy, right? And I think this is a big question. But one thing I've really been trying to practice, you know, both as a therapist, but also just in my own life is, you know, again, if we come back to that trauma paradigm, if we come back to neurodiversity paradigm, we are so quick to label and judge folks as like difficult, resistant, you know, lazy, all of these things, right? And so can we like as a philosophical or a moral position, like take that step back and instead of just quickly labeling folks being like, I wonder what happened to them or I wonder how their brain functions that this is how they are moving through the world, right?
Yeah.
I live in New York and if you see the news, right? Currently New York is being portrayed as basically like escape from New York, some kind of like hellscape scenario, right? I was just I was just in New Mexico and somebody asked me that. They're like, is New York really like we're seeing it on the news? And I'm like, no. Yes, there are folks who need help and who need support. But number one, this idea that like we've been taken over and it's just like this, you know, complete nightmare scenario is not true. But also that doesn't negate that there are people who really are struggling, who really have a lot of trauma, like over decades, right? That's really accrued. And so now they have mental health issues or substance use issues, or they're just freaking traumatized, right? And so being in a city like New York and being exposed to all this stimuli all of the time, you have cops coming at you. Ooh, you are not going to respond well to that because it's traumatizing and it's re-traumatizing because we don't know how many bad experiences you've had in the past, right? Mm-hmm. So again, can we approach people from a perspective of, yes, I understand it's scary and it's unsettling to see somebody who is, you know, screaming or distressed, right? But instead of coming from this attitude of like, ugh, like we just need to like get rid of that person, right? Like get them off the street. Can we come from an attitude of compassion and like, wow, what has that person been through that has brought them to this place, right? And they might not want to go to a homeless shelter today because homeless shelters are also traumatizing. But can we bring them like a blanket and some warm food and maybe build a relationship? And then maybe over time, we help that person feel some safety and trust, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what I No, you asked for like steps, but I tend to think in like terms of these bigger picture things. But so I think it's more of like the attitude that we are bringing both as individuals, right? So if you're like a friend or you're in a workplace, can you have curiosity for the people that you work with who seem difficult? But also like in terms of social policies, can we have some like curiosity and empathy instead of jumping to like judgment and labeling?
Yeah. Why do you think empathy seems to be lacking? Do you think it was always like that? Or do you think there's been a uptick in a lack of empathy in the world?
Ooh, that's a great question. It's always hard to say, you know, I will say, I think right now we do struggle with empathy and I think it's for a lot of reasons. I think, you know, I think it's a society we've experienced a lot of traumas, not just, you know, COVID and 9/11 are traumas, but World War II, the Holocaust, you know, the Civil War. Like we've had a lot of traumas and a lot of global traumas also. We're a very much more interconnected society. And our past societies had trauma too, of course. But one thing that I think about is we've had a lot of traumas as a society, but we're much more disconnected than we used to be, right? Many of us, and I will speak for, you know, as someone who lives in America, right? Many of us, you know, we don't necessarily have huge families. We might move away from our families. We don't necessarily have like these communities that we belong to where we can go and we can get support, right? And that started happening, I really think, you know, really escalated in sort of the 19th century with the Industrial Revolution and people moving to cities and moving away from their communities. And that's great. There's lots of benefits sometimes. Again, I live in the city. There's a lot of benefits, but it also can mean we don't have community support. We don't have necessarily a lot of folks that we can rely on. We feel really isolated. Big, scary things are happening to us all of the time. We don't know what to do about it. We don't know how to make meaning of it, right? So we have that. We have folks, unfortunately, because of the rise of mass media, I think this happened even before social media, I think with like newspapers and television, mass media allowed propaganda to be spread, right? So you could really, a politician or someone could really easily spread sort of fear mongering, right? About the, you know, the immigrants and the women and the gays and all the people that we don't like. And that really has been able to spread to different parts of the culture. But yeah, I think we're also just very disconnected from each other, right? And so, you know, it's easy for us to have just that lack of, you know, I've been prey to this too, again, like, I don't know what it's like to be living in Appalachia. You know, I don't know what it's like to live in Texas or Florida. And the challenge, it's hard. We live in our bubbles, and we don't have those interconnections that we might have had before. And so I think that also contributes to a lack of empathy. And then it just hardens because I feel like you're not being empathetic to me and you don't understand my struggle. So why am I going to extend that grace to you? Right. So then we all just like, I think it increasingly gets worse and worse because we just feel like the other doesn't care about us. And so we just start to stay in our little bubbles, right?
Yeah, I feel like social media and mass media, like you said, it divides us. You know, you have people who watch Fox News all day long and they get brainwashed. And, you know, like you were saying, people have this image of New York as being like something out of The Walking Dead or something. And then vice versa, you have people who watch like liberal media or yep. certain people on social media, and they think that, you know, all the people in the red states are like these backwards hillbillies, like out of the hills had eyes or something. It is dividing us and it's stopping us from getting anywhere. One recent current event that kind of ties all this together, you know, neurodiversity, trauma, and social media, is the recent, it was in New York, there was a man who was killed on a subway. I know that, I think his name was Jordan Neely. Mm-hmm. Was that, mm-hmm. is that the right yes. one? And that was, you know, just reading up about the issue. And they said, like, when he was a kid, he saw his mother get killed, which that's trauma. And then he seemed to have mental illness. And it seemed like it wasn't, you know, treated properly. And then, you know, he got on a subway, maybe caused a disturbance. And then a young man, you know, I don't know if it was intentional or accidental. I don't know. That's for the court to decide, and killed him. And then, you know, once that happened, there was, you know, outrage, understandably. The conservative outlets view it one way. The liberal outlets view it one way. And then we talk about it for a week and then we forget and move on. So my question is, what's your take on that whole situation as someone who's a social worker and deals with these kind of topics?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's really very sad. And, you know, look, I ride the subway too. I'm in public too. I've certainly had situations where I feel a little leery and I'm a little like, I maybe need to walk away from this person. So I understand, and I'm not saying that, you know, in society that there's no, that we don't consider safety. Safety is important, right? And, right, I think this case shows just how many failure points there were, right? Which is just, that's what's really so tragic and so sad is there's so many folks where it's just like accumulating trauma over and over and over again. And for people who live on, you know, kind of the margins, they don't have access to the health and support that they need. You know, mental health treatment is not great for people who can't really afford it. You know, people, and this is, I'm not insulting my fellow therapists, they are doing the best they can, right? But a lot of like community clinics and Medicaid clinics are not super well funded. They're very overworked. There's a lot of incentives to like not spend time on trauma. You know, trauma therapy can take years because it takes a really long time sometimes to understand what's happened to you and to try and make sense of it. But that's not really incentivized. And so we rush people through. We try to just get them fix the surface level issue, right? Like get them to feel less anxious, maybe get them a prescription and get them out the door. And then on top of that, they're dealing with their lives are unstable, right? Like there are a lack of housing, a lack of job security or food. And so are you really going to want to go to trauma therapy when you don't know where you're going to sleep tonight? Maybe, but maybe not, because there's other things that are demanding your attention, right? And then certainly, I think in the last few years, you know, so many things like shut down during COVID and any, you know, folks who were trying to get access to community and services, and then they couldn't And that also really negatively impacted a lot of folks, right? So again, what it speaks to is when we think about trauma, I really would like it to not just be this buzzword that it becomes, where it's like trauma informed, and more, you know, how can we get people, like if someone's unhoused, can we find a way to get them some kind of stable housing for a while, right? And we have a little bit of that. We have supportive housing in New York. It's got its own issues. How can we make sure that though that we are getting people housed and fed and get their basic needs met so that then they really can maybe benefit from therapy? How are we intervening early, right? Like really trying to get kids and teens into good quality therapy, right? Not just with interns, because again, we tend to do that, right? We tend to send therapists who are in grad school, intern at this school. And again, interns can be really great and lovely, but they're there temporarily. They're just starting out. How can we get folks really good care, you know, as a young person, right? So that hopefully someone catches some of this stuff beforehand and recognizes it, and gets someone the treatment or therapy that they need early, right? And then again, yeah. Like, how do we as a society, how do we, you know, stop turning to policing and incarceration as the only solution when maybe mm-hmm. someone needs a place to sleep and therapy or yeah. community too?
Yeah, I feel like we're using the prison system as a replacement for what should be, I don't know if asylum is the right word, but yeah. What's another word? Because asylum, when I say asylum, I think of like Arkham Asylum with a bunch of crazy people. Yeah, but like a mental health hospital, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah, the rates are very high in prisons. Unfortunately, jails and prisons are basically like mental hospitals. They've replaced mental hospitals at this point. It's really unfortunate.
Yeah. So I have two little questions and then we'll wrap it up. Is a core issue of, you know, the failure to help people with neurodiversity and trauma, is it just like lack of money and resources being put into these programs?
I mean, I think that's a big part of it. Yeah, I think lack of money and resources is huge. And I think the other core issue is just like a lack of, I was going to say lack. The other core issue, there's a lot of things. I think lack of money and resources is huge. I think lack of understanding is a big one. And I think there's a lot of just fear and anxiety that we have around anybody who's different. And we kind of just don't want to deal with it. I think that's a big part of it.
Mm-hmm. What about burnout? I have interviewed social workers before, and one guy interviewed, he said the average lifespan of a social worker is like 2 to 3 years. And so there's like a lot of turnover. Yep. How do we address that?
Oh, that is a great question. So yes, it's a huge, huge problem in our field, and it's awful. It's really sad. I think there's a few things that we can do. Again, it does come back to money. Like we have to, as a society, say that this is worthwhile and that it's worth paying people appropriately to provide these services, right? So that's number one. Number two is, again, we need everything. We need more of everything, right? I know I'm asking for the sky, but we're asking for the moon, but we need, so because social workers get burnt out, they're underpaid, they have high caseloads, and a lot of times they're asked to do the impossible, right? Part of what burned me out a little bit from being in agency work and why I moved into a group practice is it's so frustrating to see year after year after year of people who want housing, and they are out there and they are looking for apartments, right? The city gives folks vouchers to get housing, and they are calling landlords and they are applying for housing lotteries, and years and nothing is happening for them. And it's not because of them, but it's because the money that they have from the city and the availability does not match, right? And some of these folks, you know, they want to work, but you know, am I going to lose the services that I do have if I do work? Am I going to make enough money if I'm working to actually pay for housing on my own? All these things. And so as a social worker, you're trying to hold all of this and trying to help people and knowing that at the same time, there's not a lot that you can do to help them. Right. And that's really draining and really discouraging. So I think we need to pay social workers better and hire more so people are not so overstretched. But again, we need to look at like these larger systemic issues because social workers, you know, I can't fix it. I can connect you to the services, but if those things don't exist in the first place, there's only so much that I can do. Right. And then lastly, I just think we really need to invest in social workers and this whole profession and really see it as valuable. So that means having really good supervision and training and education and really say like, you know, this is important. This is a really important piece of our society and our culture. And we're really going to value it. And we're not just going to treat it as like, oh, that's a cute, that's so nice that you do that, right? I'm going to go to Wall Street and make, you know, seven figures as an investment banker, but it's so cute that you do this job. Right. I'm not asking to make $1 million, but I would like to be compensated for my work, you know, and I would like my work to be respected. I want my clients to be respected. Right. So comes back to money, right? Money and care.
Yeah. All right. Hey, this has been a wonderful conversation. I learned a lot and I'm pretty sure my audience did too. One last go a couple of things and then we'll go. You mentioned books that people could read. What books would you recommend about neurodiversity? Do you know any off the top of your head or?
Yes. So Unmasking Autism is a great book by Devin Price, which talks a lot about autism and particularly how autism presents like in women and folks who are not that stereotypical little boy and how people have masked. So I think it's a great understanding of that. There's a book called Neuro Tribes. I think Steve Silberman is the author, and that's a good book if you're interested in learning like the history of autism. I think that's a pretty good resource for folks. So those are two that I would recommend. If you're interested, Steve Silberman is not autistic, I believe. Devin Price is. But yeah, I definitely recommend if folks are looking, like try and look for books written by folks who are neurodivergent or really have a lot of experience working with neurodivergent folks. But those are two books I would recommend for that.
Awesome. And do you have anything of your own to promote?
I'll just promote myself right now. So if you are interested, you can find me online. My website is sarahelldridgelcsw.com. So that's Sarah spelled S-A-R-A. My last name is Eldridge, E-L-D-R-I-D-G-E-L-C-S-W.com. So you can learn some more about me. You can get in contact with me. I currently, like I mentioned, work at a group practice called Liberation Based Therapy. We're based in New York, but feel free to give us a Google if you're interested. I also work when I'm not a therapist. I work for an organization called Minding Your Mind, and we do workshops for youth and for parents and teachers around topics related to mental health. So we talk about anxiety and depression and identifying your feelings and trauma. So if that's something you're interested in, again, Minding Your Mind, you can look them up. We do virtual and in person. And also me, I'm available if folks want to chat or interested in learning more about trauma. I do consultation and supervision for, you know, therapists and, you know, training. So I'm always happy to get to talk to more folks.
Awesome. All right, then. Like I said, this has been a great conversation. Thank you for meeting with me and you have a nice day, Sarah.
Great. Thank you so much, Isaac. It was great talking to you.
You as well. Take care.
You too.
All right, that's a wrap. Thank you for joining us for another enlightening conversation here on Bright Brains. I hope you've gained valuable insights and inspiration to fuel your own bright ideas. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe, rate, and leave a review on your favorite podcast platform or however else you listen to this podcast. Also, we can be found on all major social media. Just type in Bright Brains with a Z.
And remember, the brightest minds are those that never stop seeking knowledge.